The next case on our calendar is 04-1811, Disciplinary Counsel versus Christine Ann Johnson. Mr. Burden.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jim Burden of Akron, Ohio, and I will address the court for 11 minutes on behalf of Christine Johnson, who is the respondent as well as co-counsel, reserving on rebuttal 4 minutes for Christine. The facts in this discipline case are almost wholly uncontroverted. Perhaps the best evidence that that is true is that there were 49 stipulations of fact entered into between relator and respondent at the disciplinary hearing. In addition to that, if you review the relator's brief, there are no less than 15 paragraphs under the statement of facts, and 11 of those refer to the stipulations as the basis for the comments made in the facts. There's also a chart, which is admittedly derived from the stipulations also. The reason I mention that is because it presents for this court a question not of what happened, but what conclusions should be derived from the known and the admitted facts. At the May 13th hearing, for example, there were three violations. Those violations involved conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, fraud, and misrepresentation, conduct adversely affecting her fitness to practice law, and collecting a clearly excessive fee. In the briefs of this case, as well as at this hearing, the respondent, Christine Johnson, admits that that she did submit bills which were excessive, and thereby she collected an excessive fee, and as a consequence, it reflected upon her fitness to practice law. We did not, however, at the hearing, concede dishonesty, and do not today. We thought at the time of the hearing, and by we, I mean me in particular, and Christine Johnson agreed, that the charges were also interrelated to the facts that by admitting one, we might necessarily create the suggestion that she was conceding dishonesty. As a consequence, what she presented at the hearing were the undisputed facts, and she left the conclusions regarding those facts to the disciplinary panel. Now, having read the board's report, she accepts the conclusions that they made regarding two of those allegations. And I will speak to the issue of dishonesty because that's a conclusion with which we respectfully disagree. In summary, the board found that on 13 occasions during the calendar year 2001, Christine Johnson submitted, quote, false inflated bills to Stark County for attorney fees for court representation in juvenile court, end quote. Although Christine appeared before the juvenile court, I believe on an average of 3 times per week during that calendar year, there were 13 bills that are in question. It's important to recognize what they did not find. There was not a fabrication of the bills. That is, that Christine Johnson did not include an entry of time spent for a respective client for hours that she did not work. What the complaint was is that she essentially double billed. That is, that when she appeared in court for 3 clients, all of which were appointed, she would submit a bill to the court for each of those clients. And if she spent 3 hours in the service of those 3 clients, the county received a bill for each of those for 3 hours. The complaint states that there should have been a billing for 3 hours, not for 9 hours, and she should have apportioned that bill among the clients.
And there isn't any question about that, is there?
No, there is not. Okay. And that's why she concedes excessive billing in the conduct. There is a suggestion in the relator's brief
did she get into this by essentially billing for a procedure rather than for time? I mean,
I think that's in part true, Your Honor, but
is that how she justified it in her mind? I was there for the initial plea hearing for the child, and I was there for the dispositional hearing.
I think
and,
there was.
The standard fee for that ought to be such, but there wasn't a standard fee for those. I mean,
there was not a standard fee for the time spent. There was a standard fee, an hourly rate of $30 for out-of-court service, $40 in-court service.
Right. And the judges had not set up a fee that if you represent a child through these procedures, this is what your fee is, regardless of how much time you spend.
No, there was no such rule, Judge, from the judge in the juvenile court, any one of the three judges that were involved in this case.
But the judge approved the statement that she submitted.
They did, Your Honor. What I was going to point out in response to your question, sir, was the mental machinations, if you will, that she went through in order to do what she did in the bill in the manner that she did. There were actually three basic reasons. The first of those reasons was that says she was a legal secretary for 14 years for Darrell Holland, who is a co-respondent in this case. His case will be heard tomorrow. And during that 14 years, she filled out his indigent fee application forms as his secretary, typed them, and in fact, on many occasions, delivered them to the court for payment. She adopted exactly the same policy of billing, double billing, if you will, that she had learned through that 14 years as a legal secretary for Darrell Holland. Second of all, she had personal experiences during her rather short legal career from May of 1999 through 2001. And during that time, she encountered the billing practices of other lawyers. And at the disciplinary hearing, as well as at the criminal trial, Wayne Graham, a rather respected and well-seasoned attorney in Stark County, testified that this billing practice was utilized by many attorneys in the billing systems through the Stark County Juvenile Court, that he himself had done that. And thirdly, she thought, and I accent the word thought because she had no direct contact with a judge who said your billing practice is approved, but she thought that they were approving her billing practice. And that also was for three basic reasons. One is that, as the justice just said, they approved by their signature the fee applications that were submitted and certified themselves that they had read her application. But if they did that rather perfunctorily, as one might guess that they did, in addition to that, what was communicated to Christine Johnson was that they were scrutinizing the bills because on occasions they would reduce the fee amount. So she thought that they were actually reviewing what she did when she submitted these bills.
Now, counsel, these bills, though, were separate for each defendant. So a judge, for example, would not get a request for payment, 3-hour payment on three separate defendants on one sheet. I mean, that would have been obvious. Here we have three separate sheets going out, potentially, I'm guessing, to more than one judge at a time who have no idea that there is double billing going on.
Well, it was not on one sheet, Your Honor, but they were all submitted at the same time. For example, if she entered an arraignment and entered a 3-hour bill for each of the three, on most occasions she would submit all of those bills at the same time for approval. And the reason that's important is it indicated that she was not trying to deceive anybody by what she was doing. She was, in fact, just abiding by the practice that she had learned over 14 years as a legal secretary.
Counsel, were these submissions done at the conclusion of the case?
Yes, they were.
So case A, B, and C had some overlapping time for a 3-hour increment, maybe on more than one occasion. And you're saying that all three applications for fees in the three separate cases were submitted simultaneously to the same judge.
That is correct.
And that it was the usual practice over the year and a half that she was doing this.
It didn't always happen that way, but most often happened that way. There were exhibits that were presented at the disciplinary hearing that are part of the record that demonstrate that if she had three clients on the morning of April the 1st of 2001, she would not only submit all three of those client bills at the same time to the judge, but she would also submit them the same day, and in many cases, the day after the hearing, when it was freshest in the judge's mind, whether she had been there and for what period of time and for how many clients. And I'm not criticizing the courts. I'm just trying to explain that's why Christine Johnson believed that the policy of billing that she had learned over 14 years was understood and accepted by the court system.
All right, and your argument is that, number one, maybe the judges were not scrutinizing these as closely as they should if this is, in fact, not the practice that's approved, and apparently it's not. And number two, she's only following the direction of Mr. Holland here in how he did it. And nobody ever told her this isn't how you bill clients.
It is absolutely clear that she was not told anything different. Everything that she learned suggested that what she was doing was proper. There is a state defender's handbook which tells you, at least in some general respects, how to bill, but surprisingly, none of the judges, none of the court officials, none of the people in the auditor's office, nor the investigators ever saw a copy of that or even knew that it existed. And that included Christine
Johnson.
There
was no seminar for court-appointed counsel put on by the Bar Association or the courts?
There were not, Your Honor. That was in the record of the testimony, not only at the criminal trial, but also at the disciplinary hearing.
Counsel, was there nothing in her upbringing that told her how to judge right from wrong?
Well, I'm sure that there is, Your Honor. The question here is not whether she billed excessively, because she concedes that. I don't think it was dishonest to do what she did because of the circumstances that I've just presented here in response to your questions.
You mean because you do something that you inherently would know is wrong, but because everybody else is doing it and the judges aren't catching you on it, it's not dishonest?
No, I think it's not that the judges weren't catching it. I think what they did do, Your Honor, communicated to Christine Johnson in the infancy of her practice that they had adopted that rule themselves. They didn't say that they had done that. They didn't agree that they had done that, but that she believed they were scrutinizing her bills because they actually corrected them.
And I know there are judges around the state who feel the hourly rate allocated for defense counsel, appointed counsel, whether it's juvenile or adults, is woefully inadequate. Is this a case? Are you suggesting that the judges were embarrassed by or displeased by the hourly rate that was available, and so they gave the green light to double up and triple up here?
I mean, I understand the
practice
you mean, Judge.
That we have here doesn't surprise me. I suspect that this is done a lot of places. And is that the insinuation that the judges, because the hourly rate is so inadequate, are just sort of saying, you know, if you can get a twofer today and run the clock on both of them, that's just your good fortune?
Well, I think that the only suggestion I have that some of the judges may have thought that way is Attorney Wayne Graham testified that he had some personal conversations with the judges, which suggested to him that's what they were doing. In addition to that,
but once it blows up in the newspaper, of course, they all deny that.
That's exactly what happened in this case, but I don't know, Your Honor, what they were thinking or what they knew, except in one specific instance. They had what they called blitz days.
So we're left to infer what may or may not have. I mean, it may well be that the judges who may have felt this rate is too low knew that that's all the money available and expected it to be billed appropriately. So
I know that's what Christine Johnson thought, and I do know that there was one.
No, that they expected it to be billed appropriately by the hours actually spent. In other words, the judges didn't believe that they'd given a green light to any overbilling.
I have no evidence.
We don't know.
No, I don't know the answer to that, Judge. I know only in one circumstance where you could draw that reasonable conclusion. They were called blitz days, and that's part of the record. And during,
they were all what?
They're called blitz days, and you'll see this as part of the record. On a blitz day, the judge would call in a couple of lawyers and ask them to handle a lot of juvenile cases all in one 7.5-hour time span. But it was by agreement with the judges, and it was part of the record, and with Wayne Graham and Christine Johnson in particular, that they were told before the day began that they would receive $1,000 for their blitz days and they should make their fee application accordingly. And that's what Wayne Graham did. He drew up the fee application for both Christine Johnson and himself, submitted it to the judge for approval, and he did. And that included not only hours that they did not work, but it also included out-of-court service, which they had not performed, which the judge specifically approved. From that, Christine Johnson also drew the conclusion that the judges were not concerned about the hours, they were concerned about the rates.
Let me ask you a question that no one has apparently addressed. This conduct was detected by the Public Defender's Office, apparently the State Public Defender's Office, and because it has to reimburse, or it reimburses some of the cost here. Public Defender's Office is always, seems always without sufficient funds to provide all of the representation it wants to provide. Should we be concerned at all that this conduct in Stark County in effect can deprive some people from being represented by the Public Defender's Office because there are not sufficient funds?
I think that certainly should be a concern of this court, although it didn't seem to be a concern, nor did it seem to in fact happen in Stark County. To my knowledge, there was no evidence at the criminal trial or at the disciplinary hearing that suggested that somebody was not represented. That was never an issue, was never testified to by anybody. It was, however, mentioned as a concern in the panel's report in this case. Now, when I said that Christine Johnson drew a reasonable conclusion that the judges were approving these fee applications consciously, and that she was not attempting to deceive anybody for the reasons that I've already recited, that's a conclusion that's not reached just by me, but when Judge Mark Wiest heard the criminal trial, which was essentially the same facts, he said in part in his oral opinion, quote, "I can't find that anyone was knowingly deceived here," end quote. And he's referring specifically to the practice which I've just outlined.
Counsel, what would your suggested sanction be here? What are you asking this court to do? Because we have before us a recommendation for 1 year suspension with 6 months of that stayed. What would you deem as an appropriate?
I think the whole penalty should be stayed, Your Honor.
So 1 year suspension with 12 months of that year obviously stayed.
Yes. Neither I nor Christine Johnson expects that excessive billing and conduct which adversely affects reflects upon her fitness to practice law should be ignored by this court, but I think the suspension being totally stayed would be an appropriate disposition.
Thank you.
Mr. Burton, we've taken you well over your time. I'll let Ms. Johnson talk for a minute if she wants to speak, or if she wanted to talk on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, okay. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Respondent Christine Johnson submitted over 50 false and inflated fee applications for court-appointed representation to the three Stark County Juvenile Court judges. This occurred on 13 specific dates in the year 2001. The fee applications had clear instructions that required time be accounted for in 6-minute increments. Further, the fee applications required the signature of the attorney applying for the fee to attest to the accuracy of the fee application.
Mr. Berger, is there anything in the record, in the transcript, that indicates that she ever asked anyone if this was appropriate or why the form says one thing and she's permitted to do something else? Do you know?
Your Honor, in the record, and respondent stipulated as well, that the judges were not aware of, nor did they approve of, her billing procedures. Respondent's explanation at the hearing, according to the transcript, was she believed that her 3-hour billing increment was appropriate based upon the amount of time she spent at the court.
Counsel, so she's not saying that it was standard in the practice amongst attorneys that do this type of representation?
Your Honor, in the testimony at the hearing, there was testimony from one other attorney who practiced in Canton taking court appointments. He did not testify that he billed in a 3-hour increment, such as Respondent Johnson today and Respondent Holland tomorrow. There was no attorney who appeared before the disciplinary panel who testified they billed in the same manner as Respondent Holland and Johnson.
Well, what did that person testify to then as to a billing practice? It was represented to us that there was somebody that corroborated this as being an accepted practice.
I believe that Mr. Graham's testimony was that basically the way that Ms. Johnson billed was a three-hour increment for each client she represented. If she represented multiple clients on the same
day,
we
understand
three
that.
Hours for each. Mr. Graham testified that he started the clock with all three clients when court began. When he was completed with the first client, that client's clock stopped. When he was completed with the second client, that client's clock stopped. So he was not billing for the entire time period for all three of the clients. By billing in a three-hour increment, Respondent Johnson did four things. First, she billed for more time for each individual client than she actually worked. Second, when she was representing multiple clients, she submitted bills for a single day's worth of in-court work for more hours than the court was in session. Third, on six occasions, according to the record, she billed for more than 24 hours in one day's time.
Counsel, I think we understand how this worked and how it seems to be in violation of what the forms tell you to do. But this business of what was the standard practice, and maybe not just in Stark County, maybe a lot of other places, maybe not on the scale of this, I wouldn't expect that any lawyer is going to step forward and say, oh, yeah, you know, we showed her how to do this. It's what we all do, because you'll be after them next, and they'll be next week's case or next month's case. But the records of that are the overall records that are submitted to the court and then to the public defender for reimbursement, did you look at all at that to see whether or not this had just become a practice that the judges blessed or somehow justified in their courts? And there and while you're answering that, there was also this discussion of Blitz Day. I think I understood the name correctly.
All right, Your Honor, first, yeah. With regard to your first question, the prosecutor's office investigated the totality of public defenders billing for a two-year period, 2000-2001. In doing that, they discovered three different attorneys who they believed to have billed excessively based upon billing for more hours than the court was in session, billing for more than 24 hours in one day.
So in the community, there was a big look at this to see if there was
that's correct,
an ongoing scandal that involved all the lawyers in town that practiced in these courts.
That's correct, yeah. Your Honor. With regard to the Blitz days, there is one major difference between the Blitz days and the billing that Respondent Johnson was doing on a regular basis. That is, on a Blitz day, the attorney and the judge met in advance and agreed upon the fee explicitly. No such agreement took place on these individual fee applications. Each time Respondent Johnson submitted a fee application.
So on the Blitz days, the fee was more than the rule authorized, but the judge had approved that.
That's correct. In advance, the testimony showed a judge would approach an attorney or several attorneys, request that they participate. They would negotiate the appropriate fee in advance so that all of the parties knew what the terms okay. were.
How many lawyers were in this field that was reviewed by the investigator? You said there were three. They detected three that were improperly billing. Do we know how many? Does the record tell us how many lawyers were?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record indicates how many lawyers were examined. The record does indicate the public defender's office examined the records from that particular region, reported back information to the prosecutor's office. They investigated and then brought forward prosecution of three attorneys.
So do we have one more attorney coming down the pike on this case?
Your Honor, we have Respondent Johnson today, Respondent Holland tomorrow. The third attorney, Ralph Lackey, a complaint was filed against him. Based upon the difference in the facts and situation, the board dismissed the complaint. In the board's decision to dismiss the complaint, they differentiated Lackey's circumstances and situation as something separate and apart from the current case before us. Respondent Johnson's actions were deceptive for several reasons. First, her billing practices ignored common sense and what was appropriate to bill a client for. Second, her billing practices ignored Disciplinary Rule 2106, which requires ethical considerations in billing, which every attorney is required to be familiar with. And third, her billing practices ignored the expectations spelled out on each form. And Respondent Johnson testified she reviewed the form, she read the form, she understood the form prior to completing it and signing it. Respondent Johnson attempts to suggest because the judges did not reject her bills, somehow she thought that they were approved. But this misses the point that her bills should accurately reflect the time that she spends, not what she hopes to be compensated for or what she thinks she can get away with.
Do we know that I'm interested in the trial court's, obviously we don't have to follow trial court's decision here, that he said that nobody was knowingly deceived here. When the public defender's office receives the request for reimbursement for payment of these fees, do we know in what form the public defender's office received? Does the record tell us what the public defender's office, they obviously, somebody there obviously found something's wrong here. I'm looking at the deception issue. It seems to me possibly the public defender's office was deceived. They're not the judges up in Stark County who sign off on these things. They get a form or whatever, they mean in the public defender's office, that says this is the reimbursement to which we're entitled. Do we know what that form looks like? The record have?
Your Honor, the record in this matter does not indicate, but I believe the public defender's office received the same fee application and the package that was submitted to the judge in requesting the fees. And by examining those documents in totality, that's how they were able to determine that there was some potential overbilling by the respondent. But the record does not indicate clearly exactly what they received. Respondent claims that she did not intend to deceive, but her present claim of subjective intent does not hold water. The actions she undertook in completing each of these 55 fee applications involved deception of the court. When she wrote 3 hours, claiming 3 hours of time for an arraignment hearing on a day that she did not devote 3 hours of time in representation of a client, she was providing the court with deceptive information. Then when she signed the fee application, she certified the accuracy of it, and the judges relied on the accuracy of those forms in making their fee decisions. Respondent testified at the hearing when she was representing three clients, client A, B, and C. She billed each of those clients for the time spent on all of the clients. So even when she was advocating on behalf of client A, the meter was still running for client B and C, and they were being billed for the work she was doing for client A. Respondent suggests that a stayed suspension is appropriate in this matter, but a stayed suspension is contrary to the violations present and contrary to this court's prior case law. In the past, this court has held, when it is an isolated incident of dishonesty and not a course of conduct, a stayed suspension may be appropriate. Clearly, it was established, and the board found there were multiple instances of overbilling for hours not worked, and it was a course of conduct that persisted for many months until halted by official investigation. This is clearly not an isolated incident and does not merit that exception to being suspended.
Counsel, do you know, has the hearing brought out whether this was the mainstay of Attorney Johnson's practice, doing court-appointed work for the juvenile court?
I don't recall that being established in the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
Additionally, this court has held in the past, when dishonesty by an attorney does not involve a selfish motive, or when the attorney shows remorse and accepts full responsibility for the wrongfulness of the misconduct, a stayed suspension may be appropriate. Clearly, that's not the case in this matter. Respondent Johnson's actions were committed for a selfish motive to enrich herself and increase her fee. And the record demonstrates amply at the disciplinary hearing she declined adamantly to acknowledge the wrongfulness of her conduct.
Does it make any difference the fact that in the criminal trial, Judge Wiest found that there was no knowing deception by respondent? Should we take that into consideration?
In the past, this court has held the resolution of a criminal matter does not have, is not binding on this court in a disciplinary complaint. Further, I would suggest, if you look beyond simply, the record seems to indicate the court found that because she submitted her applications openly to the court, there was no deception. If you look beyond that and to the applications required a different standard than the one respondent employed. The judges were relying on respondent to utilize the standard written on the application. Respondent signed the application certifying that they were accurate. That's where the deception lies. Every time she completed an application and wrote in claiming to have worked hours that she has not completed, that was the deceptive act. And this court has held in the past, dishonesty by an attorney that did not involve a client or the courts may merit a state suspension. Clearly, the dishonesty involved the submission of false and inflated fee bills to the court, so a state suspension is not appropriate.
Counsel, let me ask another question. Did she ever submit a correct application? Does the record show that where she did not triple bill or double bill when she had the opportunity to do so based on her idea of what was appropriate? Did she ever do it the other way?
Your Honor, I don't know that that question was asked exactly in the record. Respondent did testify that she had billed in this manner a three-hour increment for every client since she had begun practice in 1999.
Okay.
There are several disciplinary cases previously decided by this court that give us some guidance as to the appropriate sanction. First, in Toledo Bar Association versus Batt, this court found that Batt had billed several clients for more hours than worked. This court held padding client bills for hours not worked was the equivalent of misappropriation. Further, in Cincinnati Bar Association versus Nyeighbor, Nyeighbor was a court appointed to represent a client and was required to travel out of state in that representation. He took his family along and made a family vacation out of it. He then submitted a fee reimbursement voucher claiming not only his legitimate expenses, but also the expenses incurred partially in his family's travel. Nyeighbor was given a six-month suspended sentence, and this court held seeking reimbursement from public funds for financial matters not related to the defense of a client merits an actual suspension from the practice of law.
Counsel, what was the actual amount that we're talking about here for the overbilling?
The prosecutor in Stark County estimated about $8,100 in overbilling or double billing by Respondent Johnson.
Thank you.
Further, the American Bar Association has issued an advisory opinion stating billing several clients for the same time period is contrary to the ethical rules. There's an additional issue raised by respondent in her brief that I'd like to remark upon. Respondent, for the first time in her brief, states she realizes her conduct was overbilling and wrong. The reason why I point this out is this is 180 degrees different than her testimony at the hearing. At the hearing, respondent was steadfast in her testimony that her conduct was not dishonest, that she did not misrepresent the number of hours she worked for each client, that her billing practices were proper, ethical, legal, and professionally appropriate, and that she was entitled to the fees that she billed for. Respondent's newfound remorse is suspect and should have no value as mitigation in this matter.
Well, now that even makes it more difficult. We have this argument from time to time about remorse and what weight that should have in these cases, and now now we have to quibble about newfound remorse versus remorse from the start. Aren't we to at least assume that by the time she's here, if her position is, I made a grievous error, it was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, and I'm sorry, don't we have to accept that?
Well, Your Honor, I just felt...
I mean, we can note that it took a long time, but now you suggest we should split hairs about the sincerity of it when it finally comes.
Your Honor, based upon the record, I felt compelled to point out the complete opposite representations by the respondent and point up the apparent conflict between what she represented at the disciplinary hearing when she spoke on her own and what she's representing now through the brief drafted by her attorney.
We can see that.
Was there any request for reimbursement of the overbilled amounts to the public coffers?
It's my understanding after the resolution of the criminal matter, the parties negotiated and the overbilling was resolved between the county and respondent Johnson.
Do you know how much?
I do not recall if it states clearly in the record. I know there was some testimony with regard to that. I do not recall the specifics from the record.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, you may have a minute if you'd like.
What was the amount negotiated for overbilling, if there was any?
There was actually no negotiations, Your Honor. The prosecutor's office called me and said that they had a check for me. I needed to come down and sign a release. And that's what I did. I met with Prosecutor Dave Thorley. I signed a release for it. They had accused me of taking approximately overbilling about, I believe, $8,100. And I received a check from the county for $11,700.
For how much?
$11,700.
Was that representing the entire amount you billed?
Yes.
They did not deduct anything for what they considered overbilling?
No, it was $1,000 short of what I had billed them. My total bill to them for over that period was $12,700, and they paid me $11,700. I would just like to say to the court, I am sorry at so many levels for the pain that I have caused my family, my friends, and my fellow lawyers. Most of all, I'm sorry for what I put my husband through during this ordeal. When I was in my criminal trial, he was gravely ill in the Cleveland Clinic in intensive care. He was fighting for his life, and I was fighting to keep my profession that I love. I couldn't be there for him because of the decisions I had made on my court-appointed billing led me to my path of criminal prosecution. I have no one to blame but myself for the position I'm now in. I accept the responsibility that I overbilled the county, and I apologize for that. But at no time did I ever consciously set out to deceive the judges that were approving my bills. I personally delivered all my bills to the judges right after I did the bills, and I would take them down all at a time and give them to them at that point. I believe they were reviewing them because many times I got my bills back with questions or corrections that I needed to make. When the criminal investigation began, I had a huge caseload of juvenile court appointments. I continued doing them, but I billed them at that point the way I understood I was should have been doing it from the beginning.
Ms. Johnson, I just have one question. You know that the court is relying on the signature of an attorney. And when there's an attestation there that says this is accurate, and you put your signature there, the judge is believing that this is actually true. You say you read the forms.
Yes, Your Honor.
At no time, I mean, didn't this? I understand what you're saying about what you were trained by the other attorney, but at no time didn't this trouble you that you were signing papers contrary to fact?
And I'll be honest, there's no excuse for it, Your Honor. I really never thought about it. I signed my name. I turned in the bills the way I had always known and thought it was accepted. And I didn't put the thought, and that's where I have failed, to the standards the court set for me. I never thought about it. I just did it. And I do apologize for that. I've tried to give back to the profession by doing pro bono work and accepting reduced fee divorce cases. I'm sorry that I've taken for granted the privilege of being a lawyer, and understand that every single decision I make has to rise to the professional standards and ethical standards. Through all the pain and humiliation I've been through with this, I really believe I've become a better lawyer. I'm deeply sorry for my behavior, and I am ready to accept whatever punishment this court deems appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.